Thank you. May it please the Court. In 2005, Dr. Judy Norman Nunnery, an African-American, applied for a position of the DRSA administrator at MATC. She was denied that position. Because I have a very limited time, I'm going to begin on her Title VII claim using the indirect method. There really are three decision points in her indirect case. The point where she was eliminated from the interviewing process, the point where she was not added back in after they analyzed the scores, and the point where later on the affirmative action director had asked that she be added in after the fact. Now, she has made her prima facie case. There is no dispute that she is African American. There is no dispute that she applied for the job. There is no dispute that she was found to be minimally qualified for the position. And there is no dispute that she was not interviewed for the position. MATC has stated a legitimate business reason that she didn't score high enough in the depth and breadth analysis to justify her inclusion in the interview pool. So the analysis then turns to pretext, and the evidence is rife with pretext. First of all, MATC lost all of the important documents that would either substantiate its claim that Norman Nunnery didn't score high enough or would undermine their claim that she did not score high enough.
Mr. Kinney, you know, there is really no inconsistency to the explanations that I could find given for the missing documents. Assuming that there is no inconsistency, what's your best evidence that the documents were lost or destroyed intentionally and in bad faith?
Well, there is evidence of bad faith in the record. First of all, during the Equal Rights Division investigation of the case, MATC was asked to produce a lot of these documents. At the time, they knew that, allegedly, these documents had been lost in a move. But instead of telling the Equal Rights Division that, they insinuated that the Affirmative Action Director, Mr. Fujimoto, had taken off with them. He was the one, they said he was the last person to have the documents, and their explanation for why they didn't have them at that point. It was only later on that they said the documents were lost in the move. That misleading information is evidence of bad faith. Second, they understood by the time of the Fujimoto meeting that there was going to be an argument over why Dr. Norman Nunnery was removed from the process. Mr. Fujimoto called the meeting with the decision makers because Dr. Norman Nunnery had questioned her elimination from the process.
Does the record tell us whether Mr. Fujimoto saw all of the relevant records before they disappeared? Did you depose him on this topic?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. I can't pinpoint a site for you. I know that he saw, shortly before that meeting with the decision makers in the case, he saw Dr. Norman Nunnery's application. I'm not sure if he saw the screening forms, but my best recollection is that he did. And then he testified that he returned them to the Human Resources Department after that June meeting.
Well, it seems that he was very tuned into this particular job candidate, and I would think he would remember seeing any evidence of discrimination on those records.
Well, in fact, he did detect resistance to his request to have her included in the process.
Well, that we know.
Yes. And I think a jury giving...
We know that you allege that.
Yes. And if a jury is entitled to draw all reasonable inferences from the record, a jury should be able to infer that that resistance that he encountered, a resistance that was noteworthy to him, that a jury should be able to interpret that as evidence that Dr. Norman Nunnery's race was an issue that prevented her from being hired. It did know by that time that Mr. Fujimoto had conducted a study, granted not statistically rigorous, but that he had conducted a study that showed that people of color did not get hired at the rates one would expect for an institution of its size and scope, that people of color did not get positions, administrative positions like this one, and they were disproportionately excluded. So the decision makers also would have been aware of that. At the same time, he was asking that this African American candidate be reconsidered, and he noticed resistance to that. There is additional evidence of bad faith, though. MATC claims that it lost the documents in the series of a couple of moves. It also testified that it stores its documents in alphabetical sections by year. If that were the case, one would expect that if documents were missing from it, they would be missing in large alphabetical sections. But instead, it's a series of documents scattered throughout the alphabet that are missing. That's puzzling and not easily explained by the explanation that MATC puts forth for why the documents were lost. Along that same line, the individual documents that were lost just happened to be all of the applications and all of the screening forms for other people who were passed through to the interview. Oh, and Dr. Norman Nunnery. The fact that those particular documents would be lost in the move, all of them, when not all of the documents were lost, is a coincidence that is just too much to believe. Turning back to the indirect case on the pretext, the lost documents is something that's curious. By itself, maybe not enough. But that is one fact that a jury should be able to consider in determining whether there's pretext here. As I mentioned earlier, their attorney was misleading about losing them when he communicated with the Equal Rights Division. The alphabetical sections, it doesn't make sense. The big coincidence. There's the Fujimoto study. Although not statistically rigorous, is another piece of evidence that the plaintiff could rely on to show pretext, as the plaintiff did in the Bell case. Not one person, not one African American or any person of color, made it past the first interview. Mr. Fujimoto detected resistance to his request, and as noted in the brief, the hiring criteria changed. They looked for direct experience later in the process, whereas earlier in the process there was no mention of direct evidence. These facts taken together would allow a jury to infer that the reasons given by MATC are pretextual. And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if there are no other questions.
Certainly, Mr. Kinney. Ms. Stadler.
Thank you. Good morning. On behalf of myself and my client, Madison Area Technical College, I want to thank the panel for taking the time to hear arguments today. I'm appearing along with my co-counsel, Wade Harrison, on behalf of the college. Mr. Kinney chose to begin his remarks with a discussion of the indirect method of proof under McDonnell Douglas, and I will follow suit and respond to some of those points. Mr. Kinney identified three distinct points in the decision-making process where he claims that Ms. Norman Nunnery was discriminated against. Initially, through the initial interview selection process, and then twice when Eugene Fujimoto requested that she be added back in. In fact, there is no evidence in the record that anyone at MATC, much less those involved in the decision-making process at point one in Mr. Kinney's analysis, had any knowledge either of her race or her marital status.
You know, it really does seem odd to argue that none of these people who had been sued in a frivolous lawsuit by Norman Nunnery's husband drew a connection when they saw her name. Why isn't she entitled to an inference that when they saw the name They assumed that she was related to Willie Nunnery, and also assumed she was African American. It sounds like that earlier lawsuit left a very bitter taste. Surely they would all remember who had done this to him. To them. You know, we're not talking about New York City here. This is a pretty tight community.
It's true. Madison is a tight community. I think what Judge Crabb focused in on is that, first of all, the Jimenez case occurred several years prior to the hiring decision for this employee.
Boy, I'd remember it until the day I died, but okay.
and if you want to go that route and discuss the memorability of that particular case and Mr. Nunnery's conduct in that case, for which he was ultimately sanctioned and suspended from practice, the most I think any reasonable person could infer from that was that perhaps Jackie Thomas and the two upper-level decision-makers who were not involved in the screening process remembered who Willie Nunnery was and may have even remembered that he was black. But that's quite a jump to go from that recollection to he must be married to this particular job candidate.
Maybe
and
not.
That the job candidate is also black. Being tight-knit or not, Madison is not the kind of community where you would want to make assumptions about people's names and what they mean about their marital or racial status, because it is really a melting pot community. And there are people in our community with hyphenated names for a million reasons other than marriage, and there's no assumption that you're married to someone of the same racial status that you are. I think what Judge Crabb concluded is all of those inferences really fall over into the level of speculation, conjecture. This court has talked about hide the peanut in terms of the standard for summary judgment. And that's what we're looking for, direct evidence where a reasonable juror could make that inference. And Judge Crabb very rightly concluded that the inferences that you alluded to, Judge Rovner, are not reasonable inferences and therefore cannot be the basis for resisting summary judgment. What we're looking for is direct or indirect evidence of discriminatory intent.
Well, you didn't respond to the plaintiff's argument that evidence that minorities are treated differently, even evidence that isn't rigorously statistical, can be used as circumstantial evidence of intentional discrimination. And, you know, that's our Troop case, which, you know, we didn't confine that kind of evidence to disparate impact cases in Troop. Can you respond to that argument and that case now?
Sure. Ms. Troop failed for the same reason that Ms. Norman Nunnery failed. She was unable to prove that other pregnant women had been terminated for discriminatory reasons, just as she was able to prove that her own termination was because of her pregnancy and not because of her repeated absences, her failure to call in timely, to find people to substitute for her, etc. I believe we did address the issue in our brief, but I will note here that Judge Crabb's conclusion that the disparate impact evidence would be relevant to a disparate impact case and not necessarily to a disparate treatment case, as Ms. Nunnery alleges. But Judge Crabb also said, you know, even if she could show some sort of system-wide failure to have minorities in positions of power and administrative positions, that does not necessarily mean that there was discrimination in her individual case. And while it is true that in the Troop case and in others, such statistical or non-statistical evidence has been considered to be a piece in that mosaic, in this case, it's a tiny little piece, and it's a very large mosaic. And the other pieces are, frankly, just missing. Because, in particular, the pool of applicants that was screened and did receive interviews included another African-American woman. So in terms of the disparate treatment in the context of this particular hiring decision, Ms. Norman Nunnery could not show that she was treated differently, even if the committee knew she were African American, because an African American woman did survive that level of the process. And then, in fact, turning to the next level of intervention, where Fujimoto made an appeal on behalf of Norman Nunnery, again, as Judge Crabb found, by that point, the horse had left the barn. The decision had been made who to hire and whom not to hire, or whom not to interview. And if at that point the committee had then given reconsideration to one candidate because of her racial status, and to, as Fujimoto suggested, make assumptions about her criteria and her qualifications for the job, that would subject all of the other applicants to an unfair situation because those applicants weren't given assumptions about their qualifications. The bottom line on the facts of this case are very, very simple. And while there are lots of fascinating legal issues associated with Title VII jurisprudence and 1981 and 1983 jurisprudence, we don't get to any of those in this case because, as the simple test suggests, the bottom line question is there any evidence of discriminatory intent? And without knowledge of either Ms. Norman Nunnery's racial status or marital status at the time the decisions were made, there cannot be discriminatory intent either under the direct or indirect methods of proof. Now, because I have a few moments left, I do want to turn to that spoliation discussion. It very much reminds me of the story of the five blind men or the seven blind men feeling different parts of the elephant, and the idea that Mr. Fujimoto, having been the last person to see the documents at issue, somehow creating an inference that the other part of the explanation, that there was a move and the documents were lost, really, as you pointed out, Judge Rovner, creates no suspicion at all because they are both parts of a legitimate explanation for the loss of the documents. And as you correctly pointed out, the standard in this circuit is whether the documents were intentionally destroyed and whether that destruction happened in bad faith. And the plaintiff in this case can prove neither of those elements. I also wanted to take a second to correct a misstatement that Mr. Kinney made about the spoliation argument. He claimed that all of the application materials and all of the screening forms were lost. In fact, many of the screening forms, including the screening forms of four of the five committee members, reflecting Ms. Norman Nunnery's scores on the breadth and depth criteria, do appear in the record. They were produced, and they corroborate Judge Crabb's finding that Ms. Norman Nunnery was not among the highest scoring applicants. If you look in the end at the resumes of the two candidates, Ms. Norman Nunnery and the woman who was ultimately selected for the job, Sandra Hall, you will see that Sandra Hall's experience, education, and credentials directly square with the qualifications that MATC was looking for this job. She had direct experience with persons with disabilities in a higher education setting, and therefore the hiring was not discriminatory. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Kinney?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
I will go backwards. The issue that opposing counsel just raised about comparative qualifications isn't relevant either to the prima facie case, and it particularly isn't relevant to the issue of whether Dr. Norman Nunnery was denied an interview. To make that determination, you would have to compare Dr. Norman Nunnery's qualifications to all of those who did make it into that first round, and we don't have that information. I do want to apologize if I was misleading at all. There are some of the screening forms that remain, but the screening form that counts, Jackie Thomas's screening form, the one with the final score, those are missing. Those are gone. With respect to fairness at the Fujimoto argument, a jury should be able to infer that that was not actually a concern of the decision makers, that to let Dr. Norman Nunnery in at that point would be unfair. They already acknowledged at the depth and breadth screening level that they had added two people to the process who they admit had not scored high enough. So fairness, a jury should be able to infer, is not an honest concern. The African-American Jacqueline King, who was in the pool, MATC admits themselves, they did not know her race when she was put into that pool. Race with respect to knowing Dr. Norman Nunnery's race, Carol Bassett, one of the decision makers, acknowledged that she made the very connection that you were talking about. She just couldn't remember when she made it, and she said she discussed it. A jury should be able to infer that she made it earlier rather than later, as long as she acknowledges that she made it. I'll close talking about policy. If MATC is allowed to escape a jury trial because they were sloppy with their record keeping, that is going to become the excuse of every employer from here on out.
Counsel, the case is taken under advisement.